Fort Ben. You are steady as a rock.
Hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month. My name is Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And welcome back, Rob.
Thank you.
We missed you last week.
I know. I heard JL do an impression of me.
It was a pretty good impression.
It cracked me up. I listened to the whole episode. I don't usually do that, but I wasn't on it, so it was all a mystery.
Yeah.
It was pretty awesome.
It wasn't like deja vu. You missed a really good month of comics.
I know. I did read them all.
Oh, good.
Just so you know, I was stuck on a plane for a really long time, so I read them.
Yeah. And how was Detroit?
Detroit is doing great. It's good. Still, it's coming back, you know? It's a fun town.
Nice.
And everybody I know there are lovely people.
Well, right on. Yeah. Shout out to all of Detroit.
I got to be in Dearborn a lot.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Home of Ford. Everything Ford.
Yes. One of our little historical context notes ties into that. So that's a little tease.
Teaser for the context.
Yeah. Wow. Well, fortunately, even though you missed talking about them, we're going to get to revisit some of those issues a little bit later on in the podcast, because all of these issues that we're going to be talking about, which have the cover date of May 1964, several of them are they pick up right where last month's issues left off. We get to see Black Widow's second appearance. We get to see part two of Fantastic Four versus the Hulk, and Dr. Octopus is back for his second consecutive month. So,
yeah,
you know,
I think I had to read the other pieces. You know, it was like these are all pseudo cliffhangers. They're at least two parters.
Yes.
We've only seen a couple of cliffhangers.
That's how they get you. But before we begin, we have a special guest in the studio, and I am going to introduce him now, because that's what professional broadcasters do.
You're doing great, man.
Hey, thanks. I feel very professional. And speaking of professionals, this is like an actual honest-to-God professional comics writer.
Yes.
Yeah. The writer of Shudder, Evolution, and Stellar, published by Image Comics. He was the editor of Image's Eisner and Harvey Award-winning anthology Pop Gun. And he is somebody who knows his way around the Marvel Universe. He's written issues of What If Age of Ultron, Marvel Knights Hulk, Morbius the Living Vampire, Avengers Earth Mightiest Heroes, and Amazing Spider-Man. Please welcome Joe Keating to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Welcome. Yeah.
We are very happy to have you here.
Yeah.
So we met at Rose City Comic Con.
That's correct.
This year. And we immediately started talking old Marvel comics, and after about 20 minutes or so, we were like, we should probably put up a microphone in this guy's face at some point.
Yeah, or many points if we can. Yeah,
yeah.
Being in the same town helps. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
It's very easy to get me to talk about this subject.
Nice, yeah.
60s and 70s Marvel, especially.
Yeah.
And lately, I've been checking out the 80s a little bit, working my way through.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, 60s and 70s Marvel. I'm happy to anytime.
Yeah, yeah. So, where did your fan history with Marvel begin? So what era did you jump into, and then where did it go from there?
I have no idea. My best guess was toys in the 80s, like specifically, correct me if I'm wrong, Hasbro was doing G.I. Joe and Transformers.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yep.
They had comics. And I know, and Masters of the Universe,
yep.
which is Mattel. Right?
That was Mattel, yep.
But I knew I had those figures. But the comics, as far as anyone remembers, including anyone in my family, if that's everyone, no one knows where the comics came from. They were just always there.
Yep.
My best guess, using all the data I've accrued, has been I had to have read comics in those toys. And then, you know, 7-Eleven had comics. And I had a really cool uncle who was living with us at the time. And I'm sure he, you know, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's a thing I'm interested in. And when you're three and you start to get interested in something, I mean, luckily, at least my family was like, oh, well, he's interested in something that's not just like food and existence, you know? there's a few things that really click in mind. One is this random 80s Marvel comic.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then we rented a VHS tape of the Spider-Man 66 cartoon, which my family had to buy because I wore it out in the time that I had it. And, you know, in the 80s, that was like a down payment on a house, buying a VHS tape, you know?
$170
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Sell
I've
everything
done
we owned.
To a couple horror movies in the 80s.
So that's my best guess. And they just never left.
Yeah.
I never went to that period of time where I was like, eh, you know. there's been periods of times where, you know, like for instance, when I started going to college, where I just couldn't afford anything except
for
Savage Dragon and New X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the two things I was reading then. And but other than that, yeah, man, I just don't know. And it's always been there. But Marvel was the biggest for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was Image.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of then everything, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Marvel was a really easy thing to, like, once you got one issue of something, got a couple more issues of something.
Right.
And there were, I mean, right from the very beginning, like we're seeing with some of these issues, there were breadcrumbs everywhere. It's like, oh, you want to learn more about what was going on here? It's like, pick up this issue, pick up this issue. And
I think I can say this without bias, but I feel the 80s was the most directed attempt at Marvel to, like, we get to go all out on the getting to the public consciousness.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, my grandmother knew who Spider-Man was in the 80s. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. It's like the thing of the analog of Facebook.
Yeah,
like, grandma's on Facebook. My grandma knows who Spider-Man is.
Right.
I think my earliest Marvel memories, I was born in 76. So, like, you know, mid-80s early mid-80s was my sweet spot. And, you know, so you had the Secret Wars toys when they were coming out, like that, that was right there. When Marvel Animation really started firing on all cylinders, I was a big Transformers kid. I was a big G.I. Joe kid. As far as I know, the first comic that I actually bought from a comic store was an early issue of Transformers. Like, that was my gateway. And then from there, that was the...
Man, I don't even know that. Because my dad had a box.
So,
I read X-Men in 77 and was four. So I was born in 73.
Era were his comics?
He had comics from everywhere. In fact, I've been trying to get him on to talk about... He remembers... He had four brothers reading Fantastic Four number one and having to hide it in the floorboards in the sort of old converted farmhouse where they live so Grandpa wouldn't put it in the burn barrel like everything else. So they would pass comics around and then hide them.
See, that's my platonic ideal of how to read comics.
Yeah.
Where we have to hide this. No, I'm not even joking. We have to hide this. Otherwise, our parents are going to get really mad.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, I know it's a whole other tangent I can get on, but I feel like that is the best. Like, anytime I remember having memories, especially when, like, you know, as I got older, I was in Catholic school and Spawn was coming out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I just remember thinking, I'm going to get in trouble if my parents find out I'm reading this. And again, I just feel like that's where comics needs to always be.
I feel about music, too.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure.
Nothing sweeter than forbidden fruit.
Yeah.
Well, if I can slightly pivot us from talking about our history with comics and talk a little bit about... That's a transition. I'm really pro at this.
That was good.
Except for the calling it out. You're doing great.
Yeah, okay. That's the next thing I have to work on.
I always think jokes are better when they're explained.
Oh, yeah. Nothing improves a joke. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what was going on in the world when the comics that we are going to read this month were on the stands. So everything is cover dated May 1964, which means it was hitting the stands around March 1964. I'm going to open up our magical time machine, which is known as Wikipedia. Here's a few things that we learned about March 64. So a couple things from the civil rights movement. On the 6th of March, 1964, the literacy test for Mississippi voters was upheld. A three-judge panel of the U.S. District Court in Jackson ruled 2-1 that the state law did not violate the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Department of Justice had brought a suit to challenge requirements that voters had to be of good moral character and that they had to be able to read and write and to be able to interpret selected sections of law. Obviously, historically, this had been mostly used to disenfranchise African Americans as opposed to white residents. The tests wound up being outlawed for federal elections permanently once the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed. But at the time, you could still come up with these fairly arbitrary tests to... quote, test literacy, end quote, and make sure that certain people couldn't vote. So still a lot of work being done there. And then on the 8th of 1964, Malcolm X, who had been suspended from the Nation of Islam, announced in New York City that he was forming a Black Nationalist Party. "I remain a Muslim," he told reporters, but the main emphasis of the new movement will be black nationalism as a political concept and form of social action against the white oppressors. And we had talked a little bit a couple episodes, I think, ago about, you know, as you start seeing the X-Men more explicitly talking about civil rights, mm-hmm. Malcolm X is sort of stepping in as the Magneto role, yeah. where he's the revolutionary.
Professor X is Dr. King.
Exactly. Yeah. So
does that hold up in the reread?
It kind of does.
Because I feel like I've heard that claimed a lot. And you know, I hadn't read a lot. It's been a lot. Well, I should say it's been a long time since I've read any of the early X-Men stuff.
Yeah.
And I've always been like, oh, was that really in there at the time?
It's the thing is, like, so X-Men doesn't start out being really overtly civil rightsy. Right. They're just like a super team of teenagers. Right. But I think it's really... It starts a little bit in this issue, but a couple issues down the road, you start seeing, like, all of a sudden, people don't like mutants.
Yeah.
And there's not really a reason why they don't like mutants. They just don't trust them. They're scared of them. And so it's really starting to play off those anxieties of the era. We are in the era where civil rights is really starting to heat up.
Right.
And so you kind of factor in the lead time for, like, how long it takes to produce a comic, and the timeline lines up pretty well. So
interesting.
Yeah, it's, and I think it's also kind of interesting how, like, the X-Men wind up being used as a civil rights parallel, like, depending on the era of history, they are a parallel for a different thing. Like in the 90s and 2000s, I think it worked really well as, you know, like a parallel for gay rights and queer kids, you know, because you have the secret thing about you that nobody knows and your parents don't have it. And, you know,
it's interesting to hear that, because I feel there was a period of time when Marvel didn't really reflect the real world too much. Like in the first, like, I'm talking about like the first several, I guess, months to a year.
Yeah.
And then Stan Lee was like, well, what if we did?
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, well, hey, this takes place in New York.
Yeah.
Should I put a Beatles wig on the thing? Like, I don't know. You know what I mean? That kind of deal.
We start seeing Kennedy and Khrushchev, you know, after just a few months, they like really start referencing big, you know, news items. It becomes...
That's interesting.
The only thing, you know, of course, is that the extreme whiteness of the X-Men makes it hard, but I understand, you know, in the context of the time, they're using these.
He's got to sell books all over the country.
So. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, let me take us through the little Cold War update and maybe into the miscellaneous a tiny bit. But so in the Cold War, we had on the 10th of March, Soviet military forces shot down an unarmed American reconnaissance bomber that had strayed into East Germany. The three crew members parachuted to safety and were arrested by Soviet soldiers near the East German village of Gardelgen. I'm just going to blah, blah, blah.
That tracks.
I did take 2 years of German, but I, you know, not good with proper nouns. So on the 10th, also on the same day, the Soviet Union won the first computer chess game and the first competition between the U.S. and the USSR. Moscow's ITEP system checkmating Stanford University's Kotak McCarthy program on its 19th move.
Oh, those wily Russians and the computer brains.
So that's our Cold War update, but I want to take us into the...
That is probably the least terrifying Cold War update we have ever had to do in like 30 episodes of this show.
Usually it's just some terrifying nuclear threat or... Yeah. Or, you know, Vietnam. For the Beatles by the month, my fake podcast, on the 2nd, the Beatles have the first day of shooting A Hard Day's Night. So we were talking about the recording of the album. This is the first day they started shooting the movie. This is where George meets Patty Boyd, who is one of the loves of his life that inspires many of the Beatles songs that he wrote. So
nice.
He met her filming the movie?
On that shoot. Yeah, she was one of the teenage... girls hired for, you know, extras
to run after them or whatever,
to chase them or be on a train.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And she never stopped chasing.
And I do have to add the one little note of, I heard about the jelly beans.
Oh, okay.
So I'll do this as fast as I can.
We literally called it out. We're like, if Rob was here, he could explain to us what the jelly bean thing was all about. But
George had complained in an interview that Ringo or one of the bandmates had stolen his jelly babies, which were the soft version of a jelly bean.
They're like a gumdrop with no sugar.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, like a sort of like a gummy bear capsule. But they, he said that on an interview. Then the Beatles started getting just shipments of jelly babies from fans, and then fans started throwing them at them at shows in Europe. Luckily, They're very soft. Then they came to the U.S., where we don't have jelly babies, we have jelly beans. And then George described them in other interviews, uncharacteristically George. He was very mad. Like, they're like, imagine projectiles, just hundreds of projectiles coming at you and bouncing off your guitar and making other notes happen and hitting you in the eye. Like, one of those at just the right speed could kill you. And he was very upset about jelly beans. So that is apparently the difference between soft jelly babies and hard, hard jelly beans.
Well, wow. Yeah. America's a tough place, dude.
Yeah. I'll do one more because okay, I was just talking about Dearborn. On the 9th of March, the first Ford Mustang rolled off the assembly line at the Ford Motor Company factory in Dearborn, Michigan. I also have helped to rebuild a 1968 Ford Mustang, a 1964 and a half Ford Mustang Fastback. Totally restored them with my dad. So
wow.
They're a Ford family. My uncle Carl drives Edsel's. And has a perfectly, awesomely restored Edsel. And then I have done a lot of body work and engine work on Mustangs.
Very nice.
Awesome. So
it must be nice to be handy.
Yeah, well, I try to keep my hands clean now. I don't like to wash them in gas so much anymore.
I think we'll just do a couple more of these so that we can get to the good stuff. But there's a couple. This one in particular, I think, is going to be something that our fans are going to be interested in. But on the 11th of March, which is my wife's birthday, Gene Roddenberry wrote a 16-page proposal for a science fiction television show that he tentatively titled Star Trek. I don't know if it's tentatively titled, if that's the name he actually found out using.
Was it tentative at the time?
I think it was tentative at the time, but he was like, I guess we're going to go with Star Trek.
That was the working title, I guess. Yeah.
I know he described it as Wagon Train to the Stars. That was his pitch to the network execs, so, which is a reference that does not make any sense at all.
I was
going to
say,
anymore.
Could you imagine pitching that right now?
I'm like, I think that's Battlestar Galactica, Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yeah, exactly. and then this is a less fun story, but it is like a major historical event. And I remember hearing about this and sort of like the resonance of it. But this is sort of a sign of how the world was changing and how city life was scary. On the 13th of March, the murder of Kitty Genovese took place outside of her apartment building in Queens. New York Police Department investigators were dumbfounded to discover that 38 different, quote, respectable law-abiding citizens, end quote, admitted that they had witnessed the crime, but that none of them had telephoned the police until more than half an hour later, after the killer had returned to the scene a third time to stab her to death. But, that obviously is insane. But 42 years later, a researcher would write in American Heritage magazine, the true number of eyewitnesses was not 38, but 6 or 7. And he added that the Times article that incited all this industry about an urban horror was almost certainly a misleading account of what happened. So you have this terrible crime, but then in the paper of record, it was completely you didn't need to sensationalize something that's horrible, but it was sensationalized. And then it started giving rise to this whole narrative that cities are terrifying and which, you know, started triggering white flight and things like that. Right. So
did give birth to 911, right?
Oh yeah, it did. Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Like the easy to remember universal number that everyone can call to report a. Yep. I wonder, that's going to be something to think about. Like, 6 months down the road of these issues, like if we see something happening, like if we see, like, you know,
these headlines reflected in the storylines that we're reading. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So that's a pretty good summary of what's going on in the world. We are going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to put Rob in the hot seat for Marvel by the Minute.
Oh, man.
So don't go away. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It's time for Marvel by the Minute, Rob. You should have never come back from Detroit. If this is your first time listening to the podcast or the first time listening to the segment, there are way too many Marvel comics every month for us to go into depth on all of them. So what we do is we make Rob summarize each of the issues we're not going to take a deep dive on in 1 minute or less.
I should say a caveat, too. My summaries may be wildly inaccurate.
So the first issue that we'll be talking about is Journey into Mystery number 104. This has two stories in it. Giants Walk the Earth, which is written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Chick Stone. This one features Thor and his dad, plus the first appearance of Balder. And they fight Skag, the storm giant, and Surtur, the fire demon. Picks up right where the previous issue left off, with Odin planning on going to Earth to get Thor to get over Jane Foster. And then we have a short backup, Tales of Asgard, Heimdall, the Guardian of the Rainbow Bridge, written by Stan Lee, with art by Jack Kirby and inked by Don Heck. And it's a story of Heimdall got his job guarding the Rainbow Bridge. Are you ready, Rob?
I am.
All right, 60 seconds on the clock. And Joe, feel free to help Rob out if he's floundering, or just don't.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because he had the same page I have opened up to discuss because it is wild.
All right. Yeah, we can just jump straight to there.
Okay, well, go.
So Odin goes down to Earth, right? So he's that seems pretty normal. He's got a cool suit on. But then guess what he does? Joe, you know what he does.
So Earth is in peril, so he sends all of Earth into a parallel dimension by waving his hand.
It's such a cool drawing. And
I love how it's just like in a panel. It's like, yeah, this happened.
It's no big deal.
It's not a lot of fanfare. It's not really built up. It's not really even referenced again.
Nope.
But it's just like, yeah, it's fine. It's all there's all three, I don't know, it's 60, so how many billions of people on Earth at this point? Yep. They're in another dimension. It's fine.
And it looks like billions of people just shooting off in a big sort of rocket tube.
Yeah, it's you don't see it too much in comics at the time. Outside of, actually, this is like 20 years earlier, outside of Captain Marvel Adventures.
Yeah.
You know, the ones that are especially wild, where it's just like, oh, whatever happens. Like, there's no explanation. There's just a bunch of people off of Earth, you know? And it looks like they are physically flying into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Into this, gray room.
They're
whatever.
Like barfed off of the planet. Oh, that was the whole thing.
Holy cow. Anyway.
Okay.
Baldur's there.
And Baldur's there, too.
And then Heimdall, he can see really far, and he can hear things. It's great.
I really liked the Heimdall origin.
Yeah, you can hear plants growing.
But I think that was such a cool way to express why this guy's important.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because, again, it's not a big thing,
yep.
But it's, I can hear a plant being born across, I guess, the planet
the
of
planet?
It. You know? Yeah, it's not really explained all that much, the plane of it.
Right. I'll also mention in each of these stories, there's a Jack Kirby extreme close-up on someone's eyes.
Those are the best, but my favorite Kirby-ism is the giant hand.
Yes.
Yeah. Like the best shown is in Bicentennial Battles, where there's that whole page of dedicated to Cap's hand. But anyway, yeah, that's Kirby eyes, man.
The Odin eyes in the sky are always my favorite.
Yeah.
Those are
like talking to dad, and dad just big eyes.
I wonder if the extreme foreshortening on the hand is just like, you know how like so many artists will say, it's like, oh, the hardest thing to learn to draw is hands, is like Kirby's like, it's not that big a deal.
<It's> like, or look at how good I can draw this hands. Is due in 3 days, right? And this page is going to be mostly a hand, but I'm Jack Kirby, so it's going to look awesome.
Yep, right?
Exactly.
So, you know.
On to the next panel.
It's funny to look at his storytelling, and he never does something that's just lazy.
No.
But he does do a lot of things where it's like, this will save me a bunch of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yep. But it will also look cool and serve the story.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. We're going to move on to Strange Tales number 120. Again, we got a couple stories here. The Torch Meets Iceman, which is written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Dick Ayers. This story is all about Human Torch and Iceman meeting for the first time to team up to fight a gentleman named the Barracuda. And then we've got as a backup story, a short Doctor Strange story called The House of Shadows, which is written by Stan Lee with art by Steve Ditko. And it's about Doctor Strange entering the titular House of Shadows. I love titular as a word. It's just like, it's a very musical word.
I'll do my best to even get to that. Yeah.
All right. So I got 60 seconds on the clock. Please do your best to explain the insanity of Human Torch and Iceman meeting for the first time.
Well, can I actually make a note about it before it even starts?
Yeah. Okay.
Because I guess maybe, I don't know if it's the count starting at clock, because it's just count on page one.
Yep.
But so it says Human Torch meets Iceman. And what I really like is this note that says Ice Inquirer in parentheses, Iceman's guest appearance through courtesy of X-Men magazine.
Yes.
Which I feel like establishes like the reader with an idea of Marvel being this huge, larger thing, kind of what it actually is now.
Right.
You
right.
know, where, yeah. you, where you hear, I remember Eric Larson told us a story about on Revenge of the Sinister Six that they had to ask for permission to use Wolverine. They couldn't use Wolverine in time, so they used Sleepwalker instead.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of is a sort of predicts or builds this myth yeah. that eventually becomes fakes it till they makes it
right
yeah. in terms of getting Iceman in here.
I love it. Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's different editors. Somebody owes the rights to this. We have to negotiate it. Yeah.
People don't have any idea that it's really Stan Lee in this tiny office of Flo Steinberg yeah. and just like, you know.
Just nonstop hyperbole yep. until it works.
Okay? I love it. All right. We got 60 seconds on the clock and go.
Okay, so Bobby Drake decides he is going to go try to meet some ladies and goes on a cruise on the Hudson. And he turns out Johnny Storm is there with his lady. And
I just saw the line, there are always lots of swinging teens on these cruises.
Yep, that's what's happening. And then
that's what teens love.
It gets even better because there's a pirate named Captain Barracuda.
Mm-hmm.
And he apparently just is a pirate on the Hudson. So they board this ferry and cruise and start to try to mess with everyone. Of course, they get beaten up. He does pretty well, though, against both the Human Torch and Iceman,
yeah.
surprisingly. But both of the Torch and Iceman impress each other. Then moving on to Doctor Strange. I'll just jump there. They win. Doctor Strange in the House of Shadows. He goes to this house that this news reporter is.
That's pretty good. It's a haunted house, and then he makes the house go away.
But the house is like the house itself is a extra dimensional being,
right?
So it's yeah. like a special kind of haunted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will yeah. say with this Doctor Strange story that reading this and Amazing Spider-Man
yeah.
on everything else we read for this month really made me understand that Ditko was the most realized creator at the time at yes. Marvel. Because mm-hmm. I feel like there was still a period of time, because Jack was penciling so many books with so many different inkers,
mm-hmm.
that it took a while to really realize, like, oh, Joe Sinnott, Jack Kirby, that's Jack Kirby.
That's the team, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's the team. Whereas Ditko, I mean, because he was, as far as I understand, doing everything,
yep.
you know, beyond lettering, he was writing it for the most part, guys. Let's not
yeah.
let's split hairs. You know, but it's interesting to see that.
Yeah.
You know, and also just like if Ditko was a new creator now,
mm-hmm.
I don't know where he would be published. I mean, Fantagraphics, I guess, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Or
just self-publishing like he's been doing for the last 50 years
exactly,
or whatever.
It's yeah. been. Yeah. I was going to say, it's like he was such a. I always find it amazing that Ditko works so well inside the Marvel system for a while.
Right.
Because he had a very, very particular idiosyncratic viewpoint and style of working. And. Like, I mean, Stan talks about, he's said in interviews that with the Doctor Strange stories, Ditko brought him the finished
right,
book.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, I mean, Stan gets credit for writing, but all his writing took place after the fact. I mean, it was all like filling in dialogue, yeah, basically. Yeah. So that was pretty good.
That was okay. I would prefer to go to Doctor Strange a little bit. And I did happen to glance finally at the timer, which might help me.
Yep.
And saw 10 seconds and went, oh, man, I'm not going to make it.
All right. Well, this next one we're going to talk about, there's only one story in the book. So, you know, you should have a little bit more leeway.
That
on this
could
one.
Help.
We got a Sergeant Fury number 7. This is the court martial of Sergeant Fury.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah. Which is it's written by Sergeant Stan Lee. Art by infantryman Jack Kirby, inked by George Bell. And on the cover it says, if he's found guilty, it's the firing squad for Nick Fury.
I will say, overall, this was my favorite comic of the month.
Wow.
I think a revelation about Jack Kirby. I don't want to hype it up too much,
mm.
but I don't know. I'll wait till after your
okay.
minute here.
Let me flounder for yeah. 1 minute, and then we'll...
It's more fun to watch him flap like a fish, and then we get into the good stuff. Okay, you ready to do this, Rob?
Yeah, I think I have the high points noted in my brain.
Okay.
We'll see what happens.
You've got your 60 seconds, and they start now.
Okay, so Fury and the Howling Commandos go through a big campaign. Then they're, as usual, immediately deployed to something else, like where their pickup just flies away with something. And they're like, really? Seriously? So they, but essentially Fury meets up with a different commander that he used to know, a lieutenant, I believe. But he used to know from back in, you know, the States. But they, he is ordered to do, to attack this depot, and he... just defies the order. He knocks the commander out, and then an explosion happens, gives him amnesia, and then he wakes up and he's being court-martialed, and he can't remember why he knocked the commander or this lieutenant out, and so, or colonel, I don't know the title, but anyway, he ends up getting finally remembering due to another explosion, recovers and does not get court-martialed.
Because the ammo depot was booby-trapped. It had a bomb in it, right?
Yes. Yeah. And he knew about it beforehand, but
he forgot that he knew.
Right. Yeah. So it's a sweet amnesia story where it's just like...
Where a second concussion brings your memory back. You know, just like in wrestling, that's a thing that happens. Yep.
That's funny. So yeah, just a couple of things I noticed. One was, I've been thinking a lot lately, this is something we can go into detail later or some other time, but about the differences between Marvel and DC and intrinsically, like stuff that we kind of skip over a little bit. And I thought one of was interesting on this cover where it says the most unusual movie length war epic you've ever thrilled to. And I couldn't remember wrong, but DC for the most part always referred to a national, I guess at the time, but referred to things as the but novel length. Yeah. And I wonder if that's like, feel like if that's Lee's slight, like, okay, well, this is, I don't know why I'm doing a Kirby impression one type of Stan Lee, but anyway, that's like, we're cooler than that. Because again, I think, I don't know if at this point he's really realized that college students are reading this.
Yep.
But I feel like he wants them to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, you know, they're not like reading or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll check this out. The other thing that really hit me about this was, Glenn David Gold did a great piece about Cap's return as a reflection of Kirby's experiences during the war. Because you read early Cap stuff pre-Kirby going to war, it's really, I mean, they're not good comics for the most. They're extremely crude. And it's like, rah, rah, you know, let's go fight. And so the moment Cap comes back, he has PTSD.
Oh, yeah.
And he's seen horrors.
Yeah.
You know? And so I had that in the back of my head, I guess. And then I hit page 11 of this. And again on page 16, where it flashes back to Fury's background. And I'm like, oh, that's just old Kirby stories. Like he would talk about in Street Code or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's the way he was raised.
Yeah.
And it was making me think, you know, there's obvious parallels in his statements about the Thing and Kirby. But like really thinking about, oh, if a lot of this Fury stuff just probably came from.
Oh, yeah.
Like sensationalized versions of what he just experienced.
Sure.
War's never glorified.
Not at all.
Everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Yep.
Every single time.
Yep.
And, you know, they'll have, like, there's a page six, where there's some legit funny banter where I was, like, actually laughed out loud reading the comic. And then everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah. And Kirby's experience in war in particular, I mean, he was a scout, so he was always, like, the first guy in, like, you know, scouting things out. He liberated a concentration camp.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's like he saw that.
Well, the story that Glenn David Gold shares in the book really shows the effect of it on him, where he and, his Howling Commandos, seriously, you know, they liberated a small town in Germany, and he looks around and it's devastated. And, I mean, there's dead bodies. I mean, it's a really horrible sight. And outside of this just destroyed building, this dog lumbers out and looks Kirby in the eyes. And he said that in an interview, he was talking about how he had never seen hatred, pure, unrestricted hatred, but from another creature, like the dog looking at him.
Yeah.
The dog basically, oh, you just destroyed my home and my life. Like,
yeah.
You know, I hate you.
Yeah, right?
And so I really find his post-war comics to be fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think I really thought enough about how much Fury just is him, you know, and then until the, of course, the spy stuff later on.
Right. And then he's Steranko.
And then he's Jim Steranko, which a friend of mine said something really funny about Jim Steranko, who I was lucky enough to interview for 2.5 hours at one point.
Oh, wow.
There is a lost interview that was filmed of me interviewing him for 2.5 hours that I have no idea what happened to it. Oh. And every time I followed up on it, they're like, oh, I don't know, it disappeared.
Oh, man.
But anyway,
yeah,
that either none of it's true or it's all true. And I gotta say, having sat with the guy for 2.5 hours, I think it's all true.
Wow. Wow. I love it.
Yeah.
So. Oh, man. All right. We got a couple more of these.
Oh, man.
So we got, you're not off the hook yet, Rob. We've got Avengers number 5. This is The Invasion of the Lava Men, which is written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby with Paul Reinman. This one's sort of the Avengers versus the Lava Men versus the Hulk. No one's really on anyone else's side. It takes place right after Fantastic Four number 26 from this month, but all you really need to know is that the Avengers and the Fantastic Four fought the Hulk and lived to tell the tale. It also features an appearance by Molto the Lava Man, who Thor fought in Journey into Mystery 97 a few months ago. I think that's all the context I've got for that one.
That might be all the context I have for this one.
All right, 60 seconds around the clock. Do your best.
Okay, well, we have, it is a convoluted story of, again, Hulk versus Lava Men versus Avengers versus each other.
Yep.
There is a weird thing. There's this, like, egg.
Living rock.
The living rock that they're, the Lava Men are pushing up with this crazy contraption. It's like this corkscrew to drive it to the surface. And apparently, it's, I can't remember what it's going to do, but it's extremely dangerous. It will probably destroy everything on the surface of the Earth.
That's the way these things usually go.
And then the Lava Men can come up and just kick it on the Earth.
And it's uranium, I guess? Like, it's not really explained. Like, what?
Yeah, there's all kinds of, and Thunderbolt Ross is being a jerk and getting ready to shoot a bunch of missiles at it. And that was a nice moment where the Avengers rolling in, like, I think it's just Giant Man and the Wasp. Like, give us, like, a minute. We're going to go in here and see what we can do with this giant rock. And that was a classic, you know, we see that throughout the Marvel Universe moving forward. Hate you, Rooster.
I thought this issue was another great example, and we'll get into more of the FF issue of early Marvel and what really distinguished Marvel and DC, because there's not really villains.
Yeah.
I mean, these Lava Men are trying to survive,
yeah,
and then everyone's just fighting each other, and everyone's kind of incompetent.
Yeah.
Which, again, we'll get into more in the FF issue. And so I thought that was really great. I gave myself an experiment, and I don't know how successful I was, trying to imagine if I had never read comics before in my life, and this was the first, like, 7 or whatever.
Yep.
And like, what things would really stick out to me? One was how easy it was just to get into it.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, this guy, and this guy's that guy. Okay, great. Especially with, like, the trailer pages, like, the splash pages were very much like, ah, here's kind of what's going on.
Yep.
Which they kind of do now, but it's all text. I thought it was more interesting the way they were doing it. Not to be like an old man, like, oh, it was better back in the 60s. But I thought the way they did it here was in these comics really interesting. The other thing that stuck out to me, and again, it comes up in FF, is that Captain America is real into judo.
Yes.
Yeah. He mentions judo a lot. Yep. And I don't think I realized
judo was so impassioned. Deal. Reed Richards is also a judo master.
Is he really?
Taught Sue. Sue used some judo on Dr. Doom
like Stan,
a couple months
Stan
ago.
Read like an article about judo.
Yeah, there was like a Playboy magazine article about judo. He's like, that sounds great. Yeah, and yet it would be DC who would have Judo Man.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Man. Judo. And you know Stan was just kicking himself for not getting there sooner. Okay, one more?
Yeah, I think we skipped the human top story, the giant man story.
Mm.
I have to say, I think that's the comic has no notes on.
Yeah,
I don't know about this one.
Giant men on the last fight the human top.
The human top gets out of jail. They fight him. He goes back to jail. The end.
That's more than it deserves. We'll end on X-Men number 5. The story is Trapped, One X-Man, written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Paul Reinman. It's yet another adventure with the X-Men versus the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. I think the second time that they faced off. This picks up right where the previous issue left off. Professor X has lost his telepathic powers due to an explosion at the end of their last adventure. So we join our mutants at that point and go for it, Rob.
Okay. Brotherhood of Evil Mutants is looking for where the X-Men reside. So they've been searching. They can't find him. But we do get to see Asteroid M for the first time, which is pretty cool. That's like Magneto gets big ups. All of a sudden, he's got an asteroid.
Yeah.
Then he sends the Toad down to sort of clown around in some sporting events and use his mutant powers, which also starts to get people scared of mutants. They're like, what? This guy's totally rigging this. He's yep. probably a mutant. That does bring out the X-Men. The X-Men get him thinking he's some just random mutant that they're going to help. They all get on the subway together, which is hilarious. And then they find out it's the Toad. Big fights happen. They end up, there all kinds of craziness ensues. They go to Asteroid M. They fight. They have to like try to save Cyclops. And it's really an interesting story. One thing, unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
I've been noticing that as I reread these early X-Men, Kirby uses a lot less color in the backgrounds on these than most of the.
Well, who's coloring it?
Would that be Gold?
Yeah,
Stan Goldberg.
Maybe that is the.
Mm-hmm. They don't credit. They never credit the colorist in these early Marvel comics.
Yeah. Huh.
Which
but
is,
I would be curious who did that.
Yeah, Stan Goldberg did a lot of the early Marvel coloring. I don't know if he did all of it, but
well, X-Men. Correct me if I'm wrong. That was one of the lowest selling ones they had, right?
It was, yeah.
So I bet they were just like, let's just get it out.
Yeah, but the backgrounds are often like light gray, light blue, or elements even in the backgrounds, and to me, it makes the characters pop out a lot more, and it's just like a totally different aesthetic than the other comics,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of. My design eye kind of likes it, but it's just a notable thing that finally was sort of riding around in the back of my head and really struck me in this specific issue.
Yeah.
I got to say that ending is such a jerk move.
Yes.
Professor X is like, I had to lose my powers.
Yeah. He just pulls that crap
it was
all the time.
It was a test.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, again, it's been a long time since I've read a lot of the early stuff, but I do have that memory of Professor X as being a jerk.
Yeah.
Which I guess Kitty Pryde.
She said it right on a splash page. So. Yeah. Was it last issue where he's thinking about how much he's in love with Jean Grey?
It was a couple,
which is
yeah.
Just
but...
like,
oh right,
it's just like,
that was a creepy side thing for a minute. So
yeah, you know they mentioned that in the Onslaught storyline in the 90s, and I had not read these comics before, and I was like, that's a weird addition. Until I realized it was there the whole time,
just waiting for somebody to
dredge on
it
that
up
little piece of.
Yeah. We were all
Marvel
fine
Mania.
With just forgetting that one. You didn't need to bring that one back. But okay, cool. Well, Rob, you survived another one of these things.
Yep.
And, you know, for having a week off, I thought you conducted yourself pretty well. So
thank you.
Congratulations. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to pick up with Tales of Suspense number 53. So don't go anywhere. Okay, we're back with Marvel by the Month. It's time to talk about Tales of Suspense number 53. This is The Black Widow Strikes Again, which was written by Don Rico, plotted by Stan Lee, with art by Don Heck. So it's a little Iron Man action. Here's the setup. Tony Stark has invented an anti-gravity device. It can lift virtually anything into the air, but he can't remember exactly how he built it. So he's got this one extremely valuable prototype. It winds up getting stolen by the Black Widow, who is still hanging around after her defeat from the previous issue, and Iron Man has to get it back. So that's the stakes that we're talking about right now. I thought it might be interesting just by kind of starting off and talking about Black Widow as a character, like where she starts out versus where she winds up. So where we've seen her so far is she's like this kind of Mata Hari femme fatale, Russian agent, but she's not superhero-y.
Right.
She doesn't like have a lot of agency
right.
anywhere.
I mean, her costume is like she's a pretty lady.
Right.
You know what I mean? She's got like a fur and the dress.
And like the long like gloves, like the theater gloves.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It just, I'm such an idiot. She's dressed for a funeral. Just realizing this now.
Yeah.
I'm just realizing it too.
Us.
So you figured it out before we did.
Oh, right on. I just know.
She's got like the black veil thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like a black widow.
That makes a lot more sense.
Interesting.
She's trying to redeem herself, and she knows how to manipulate people. So that's another part of the central part of the character.
Yeah.
She can manipulate and impersonate and do a lot of things. So
It was interesting to see this too, because I realized they're kind of, I mean, I don't know how intentional it was for Don, but I don't want to call him Don, like we play baseball every weekend, Don Haig. But it has a kind of a Kniffy thing going on here, like a Milton Kniff thing.
Oh, okay.
Like especially, like, in a lot of the faces, but in the first panel, which is like one evening, that O in one evening, and then the ellipsis leading to the one.
Oh, yeah.
I'm reading way too much into it. But those in particular look a lot like Kniff. And then there's some of the line work on Tony Stark's jacket, and then a lot of the close-ups on Natasha. I feel that totally looks like Terry and the Pirates.
Yeah, I always thought it reminded me more of the model comics from the 1950s and 60s, sure. Like Don Hicks, which I think he worked on some of those. Yeah. That's just what I think of every time I see even the faces, the clothing. That's the other thing.
It's true. It's a very fashionable comic.
Yeah.
Tales of Suspense. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, it's got a sheen to it. And it's like, there's things that Don Haig does that I like a lot. I don't think he is necessarily the best at doing like superhero action stuff. But
the spy stuff in here looks awesome.
But the spy stuff looks great. Uh-huh, and it's like he's really playing to his strengths here, which is pretty cool. And at the very end of the issue, you get sort of a little tease. Iron Man, disables the anti-gravity device that Black Widow's using to wreak havoc. She's actually lifted a mountain off the ground with it. So he disables it, but then he swoops in, and he rescues some Russian agents, and the Black Widow from the falling mountain. And she says, "You saved us. I do not understand." And then Iron Man's
that
like
Western weakness.
Yeah, he's like, "That's the trouble with you commies. You just don't dig us." Stan's trying to be hip now. It's the early days of Stan's hipness. We were just talking about differences between Marvel and DC, and I think particularly in Iron Man, another thing that we see is Stan was really not afraid to go like all in USA versus commies. There was a lot of patriotism in DC Comics, but the other side was sort of vague.
Yeah.
Whereas Stan's like, nope, it's
here's
like
Khrushchev.
Here's Nikita Khrushchev in the book.
And
just really playing off of those Cold War tensions, and you know, it's like he's trying to create, you know, the world outside your window. And then there's a backup story in this.
I skipped. I don't know why I was just like, I'm not feeling the Omen today.
Yeah.
But the other one.
We're gonna skip the Omen. We're going to talk about The Way It Began.
Which I made a note about that is my handwriting. I'm a doctor's son. The only thing I inherited from him was the handwriting. I cannot tell what I wrote. I wrote some big important note about the way the Watchers were behaving, which I hope I'll remember.
Well, let's get into it and see if, or we could, you know, Nick Fury style, you know, give you a concussion and see if it comes back. Yeah, so let's see. The Way It Began, it's written by Larry Lieber with a plot by his brother Stan Lee.
Which I figured I'm not the doctor Larry Lieber, but I wrote Watchers Done on a Deadline, which was my note on this one. So pardon me, Larry.
Yeah.
Apologies. We have apologized to Larry a lot.
We had to.
But you know what, man? He was doing what he needed to do.
Yeah.
I bet there was no one else who was willing to do it.
Yeah.
And he did it.
Yeah.
And he got it done.
Absolutely.
And he got tons of these stories done for tons of comics.
Yeah. 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 I mean,
so like, good on him.
Yeah. This is basically it's the Watcher kind of origin story. We've met obviously the Watcher a few times in Fantastic Four. We know that he's under this vow of non-interference. We don't exactly know why. Now here's the story behind that, which again it's plotted by Stan, so maybe he had the initial idea and then Larry
tell a Watcher story.
There was the idea.
Like, draw it up.
Yeah. So why doesn't the Watcher get involved?
Whoa, that's a good stand.
Hey, he does it when he brings it out. Yeah.
I've tried for years. I just can't do it.
I feel like you got a Kirby.
I've got a decent
Kirby. He's got to take it on the road.
Yeah. I've got a few that are all right. But my two I guess holy grails or like I guess windmills in the distance are Stan Lee and Tom McFarlane. I really want to be able to do those. Just can't just yet.
You could complete the threesome and do Ditko and just not say anything.
That's true.
There you go. Perfect.
That's good.
Uncanny. Yeah. So, Rob, you want to tell us where this whole non-interference thing came from?
Yeah. So essentially, they're sort of this utopia. They basically solve all their problems with science. Everyone lives in harmony.
They leave piles of money hanging out.
I don't know why the piles.
Oh, yeah. Ours is the only race in the cosmos that can leave wealth unguarded on display without fear of it being stolen. And all their money's like radioactive, I guess. Like,
yeah.
It's all glowing.
But it is a pile of green bills, which I thought was weird for aliens to be like, yeah, it's kind of like your money.
Yeah.
And
but,
gold.
But eons before.
So the first thing, or one of the early things they do is they go to a planet and they want to just give them the gift of nuclear energy.
Also, these aliens look like the aliens that Larry Lieber drew whenever Larry Lieber needed to draw an alien.
Sort of like a mohawk molecule man.
Yeah,
with
he
a
does
green
look
face.
Exactly like the dude from what is the Omen? Yeah,
yeah.
It could be the same race rolling.
They're like a proto sea monkey kind of looking thing.
Yeah, pointy ears, big eyes.
Yep.
So basically they decide to teach this civilization about they're in Star Trek universe, they're breaking the Prime Directive.
Yes.
In this case, they give really touchy information to a more primitive civilization who immediately or shortly thereafter blows the crap out of each other.
Right.
Then they come back in their whatever energy forms and see that that didn't work out at all. Giving them this secret destroyed them.
Yep.
So they decide that's where they take a vow. We're not going to do that, which again is very similar to the Prime Directive.
Absolutely. And this is also like, I mean, keep in mind where we're at in, you know, in history. So a handful of countries have the nuclear bomb. It's a pretty small club, but China is definitely trying to get it. They don't have it yet, but I think that happens at the end of 64 or early 65. So there's a lot of concerns around who's going to get the nukes. And, you know, and so there is really this attitude of it's a little racist, but like you have to reach a certain level of civilization
right.
Before you can have
you have
this
to be
technology.
Smart enough to handle this.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I really feel like Art Samick needs a lot more fanfare.
He really does.
Historically, I really feel he made the feel of Marvel consistent, you know what I mean, outside of, you know, especially when there was more than one book.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Which you know, like, because Tales for Suspense looks very the Iron Man story looks very different obviously visually from any of the Kirby stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell it's a Marvel comic.
Yes.
Looking from a mile away.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know,
and his logo work was fantastic.
Oh, we always solid.
We stole every letter of our logo from it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. It's stolen from all of the 63 and 64, not all, but all of the letters are stolen from 63.
Yeah, there's so many
comics.
There's so many graphic designers in comics who I just feel like they did not get the fanfare they deserved at all.
Yep.
I mean, John Workman alone,
who was
lucked out and I won some contest, like getting him to draw Shudder. I mean, it wasn't really a contest, I just asked him to do it. which is a book I wrote at Image a while ago. But that guy, being between Marvel in the 80s and heavy metal, and, you know, oh, man, that's astonishing stuff.
So. And John Workman and Walt Simonson working together was just like, that's
so
my
good.
Peanut butter and chocolate right there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Cool. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk Fantastic Four, number 26. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It's time to talk about what the Fantastic Four are up to this month. This is issue number 26. The Avengers Take Over, which is written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby, inked by George Bell. sorry, George, but
again, you know he inked this in like 72 hours.
Absolutely. I mean,
straight.
They call it a bullpen. It was more
again,
like a sweatshop.
That's my new thing I'm inventing, the Simic test. When the lettering's bad in an Art Simic book, you know they were done with under 48 hours.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, look at that Avengers Takeover logo.
Yeah.
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 You know, if he was given one more day, it would have been the greatest thing you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No. Yeah. You're talking about the box on the cover.
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
well, no, the splash page. The cover looks great.
Oh.
The cover's super solid.
Oh,
okay,
boy.
So actually, that's a perfect example.
Yep.
Compare that Avengers Takeover on the cover to the one on page one. You're like, what?
Yep. Nope, that's...
I have to say, actually, this comic, I'm curious what you guys think.
Yeah.
In terms of guys who actually read all these recently, but I feel like this is the most Marvel thing out there at the time, this cover specifically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And everything from, like, the corner boxes there now. Was World's Greatest Comic Magazine there from the beginning? I guess that was...
It was there from, like, issue four or five.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the cool Cymac, like, boxes, and then there's those a million characters.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine being a kid who's got, like, I don't know, mono or whatever, and you're given this, and you have to read, and this is, like, the one thing you have to read over and over and over again? It's such a well-crafted... This and the Fury issue.
Yeah.
I figure were the two where I really, like, I love the craft of it.
Yeah.
In terms of how you tell a story. And, like, there's a million characters in this, but you don't get lost. And this is actually the one... And I first made the note about loving the sort of trailer splash page.
Yes.
You know, where it's not in, I mean, this one's kind of in the story because, you know, Hulk and Thing are fighting more. This is such a great example of what I feel like we kind of need to get back to in a non-nostalgic way. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think any should read the same way, but everything you need to know is on this page.
Yeah.
And after this, you're ready to go.
Yep. Previously,
on
Fantastic
Four. But I mean, like in comics now, they do have like, oh, here's a big block of text.
Oh yeah,
but that's not comics,
right?
Yeah.
And again, I'm as guilty as anybody else.
Yeah, sure.
I'm very guilty.
It's
of
a
that
shortcut. Because, yeah.
But I think this is such a cool way to do it.
Yeah.
I want to figure out, okay, what's that in 2019? Like, I don't want to do the pastiche of this, but what would this be now?
Right.
How would this have evolved?
Yeah.
If you're a kid and you open this comic, you're like, I don't know who these two guys are, but they're cool and they're fighting.
Yep.
And then all the information. So it's like a cool visual. Along with information in a way it's told in an exciting way that gets like, all right, well, I'm ready to go. Like, let's find out when the Avengers take over.
You know? Right. Yep.
I'm in.
And I like when this recently pivoted to the splash page, not just revealing pretty much the climax of the comic you're about to read.
Yes.
Like, that's what it did up until around now. It was like, and
here's the most exciting part coming soon in 16 pages.
Well, and it's relatively recently in our reading so far that comics are being continued from one issue to the next.
Like, oh, interesting.
This is something that really only started about 6 months ago.
Kidding, really?
Yeah.
Until like 64?
They were almost all completely self-contained stories.
I've kind of taken a minor, this is a huge hint, my minor break in comics is kind of reevaluate, like, what am I doing? What I want to be doing? And one thing I really want to get back to is like, here's everything you need in 17 pages.
Yep.
Period, you know, and so for my first issues, instead of use like I did on actually on a book called A Dude Called Ringside, I think the first issue was 28 pages, and I feel that there's a kind of a failure on my part in that because it's like, I don't know
you
exactly.
You give yourself too much room.
It gives you too much room, places. And it's like because the thing with storytelling in general is you want to tell the most with the least.
Mm. Yeah,
and I feel that, you know, back in the day, I'm not saying it was better or whatever. But it is interesting. I've gone back to FF number one a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And in the content, the more I learn about the context, the more interesting that comic gets.
Yeah.
But anyway.
We always talked about it as the excuse for Jack to, like, yeah, we're doing superheroes, but I'm going to draw all the monsters I've ever drawn before in one comic.
Which worked out really nice.
Speaking of monsters.
Yeah, speaking of monsters, we've got two of them slugging.
Yeah, a green one and an orange one punching each other a lot.
Guess who?
Yeah, the thing I love about this, this is either you love it or you hate it thing. I love it. So basically the last half of the last issue and the first half of this issue, all it is just a giant fight. Like it's just the Thing and Hulk just tearing up New York City and just going at it. And this is the biggest, I mean, other than when... Like that Fantastic Four annual where Namor invades Manhattan. This is like the biggest thing that they have tried to pull off in the Marvel Universe at this point. You sort of lose sight of that unless you're reading all these things, you know, like we have been. But it's Marvel, like the Marvel Universe is still a very small thing. Like, you know, there's not a lot of interconnectedness yet. It's definitely starting. And this is the first time the Fantastic Four and the Avengers meet each other. Like, I think up until this point, Ant-Man had met the Fantastic Four, and I think like Iron Man transmitted a hologram of himself to ask them if they'd seen the Hulk anywhere.
Yep, that was it.
But I think that's literally all the crossover. So
well, it's funny because I was reading these and I was like, wow, a lot of comics came out this week.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh no, Bud, the podcast is Marvel by the month.
Yeah, this is it for the month.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yes.
You know, and again, you know, comparing now to then, there's a lot of companies that have 3 to 4 books out.
Yep.
Where if they just stick with it for 50 years, you know, maybe.
Yep.
there'll be something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But people get so stuck. I mean, again, it's a tangent, a huge rant about comics now that I'll skip over the big parts, but essentially get so stuck and I want the end result.
Yeah.
I want to have 23 movies and 80 years worth of characters, or I guess, you know, from the 60s, whatever amount of years that is. But, you know, I don't, but it's like, no. Like, when they started, there was a dude in the office, a book, and then a book became two, and then three, and then now it's, what, seven?
Yeah, or eight, sometimes or nine. Yeah.
Sometimes nine. You know, it's fine. I think about that kind of stuff a lot.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's not like they're an overnight sensation, this Marvel Comics thing.
Well, that's why I get so pumped up about companies like Skybound or Vault, where it's like, we do 3 to 4 books, and they're really good.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, oh, I'm excited to see where you guys go.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, because there's a lot of companies, or there's that one TKO out now, but who just stick with 3 to 4 books and that's it. I mean, even Skybound's been around since what, 2010 or 2011? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how many books a month do they do?
Oh, yeah.
6 maybe?
Yep.
You know, so.
Well, and, you know, I think the world is full of stories of, you know, everyone who took 15 years to be an overnight success. But now you're starting to see, I think, honestly, this issue, Fantastic Four number 26, is like, this is where this stuff is finally starting to come together. You know, where you've got, okay, we've got they've got three big super teams, but the X-Men are kind of off to the side in this one. But you've got the Avengers and the Fantastic Four coming together, which I think is great. It's so the Fantastic Four, you know, as the legend goes, was supposed to be Marvel's answer to the Justice League, which it really wasn't, but the Avengers is absolutely Justice League. Like, and so you've got, you know, these are their two preeminent teams. And so, you know, it would be really easy to tell a story where, you know, other publishers might have these two teams come together and they would all pair up, you know, one person from one team, one person from another team, and they'd go off and do a mission or something like that. And then they all come together at the end. So what do they do in this issue? They have all 8 or 9 or however many of these characters, they all get together, they trip over each other, they almost knock each other out, they get angry at each other. You know, the human Captain America is trying to fight the Hulk, and the Human Torch is flying by and throwing fireballs and almost singeing Cap. You've got Iron Man getting tangled up in Reed Richards' arm lasso. You've got, you know,
Giant Man getting captured by Sue's force field because she's trying to hit the Hulk, and the Hulk is the, you know, the antagonist here.
Right, yeah,
everybody's trying to stop the Hulk, but they're all just getting in each other's way.
Yeah, there's this weird triangle between Hulk and Captain America and Rick Jones that's going on, where like Rick Jones has been Hulk's buddy, but then Cap has just come back in the last issue of Avengers, and Rick Jones looks exactly like Bucky, so Cap's like, you're my partner now,
gets it about that PTSD thing.
He's like trying to, like, he's just found himself transported 20 years into his future. He's like grasping at pieces of his old life and trying to reassemble something. The Hulk is just as damaged goods as Cap is. It's like guys are messed up.
But it's funny because, like, again, you play the test of, okay, what if this is my first comic?
Yeah.
You'd be like, why is it they want this teenager to hang out with so bad? You know? Yeah. Or I guess, the thing is, though, if you're 8, 9, 10, whatever, you'd think, oh, I want to hang out with the Avengers.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
That could be me.
So, you know.
I want to operate a ham radio.
Exactly. This is like the biggest crossover. So, I mean, that is what we're hinting at too. Like the Marvel universe and continuity is closing in into this one big action packed story right now.
Yes.
Right. Everybody but Doctor Strange, I think, is showing up here.
Mm-hmm.
And it pays off. Like I honestly went into it going, oh man, it's just going to be like nonsense of too many characters.
Yeah.
And again, this whole like everybody getting in each other's way and how they try to resolve this and how they have to communicate in order to not do it. I was like, that's a little grown up. I like it.
But it's also super solid. Everyone gets a moment and then I understand what everyone does. Like, oh, okay. So the Wasp, she has these wings and she can shrink down, or she shrinks down, and hey, this guy can, you know, become huge or tiny or whatever. Like, all right, I'm never confused.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, but it also, it's, I mean,
10 origins are explained in just an instant.
Right.
Or their powers.
Yeah. For sure. I will say, I do wonder, like, how much of this Marvel characters interacting was methodical in terms of this is the story I want to tell and the environment I want to create, or we got to sell these books. So, Fantastic Four is on the cover of Amazing Spider-Man number one. Oh, because that sells, and we don't know if this is going to sell, this backup story.
Exactly.
And could you imagine how wild that is? If you, the context of today, if you told someone, like, okay, in the back issue of Heavy Metal number 299, there's some weird backup story that's going to become the biggest comic book of the next 40 years.
Yeah.
You would never believe, you know, everyone, like, chases number ones right now. Right. You know, like, I want to be the next number one thing.
Yeah.
And I guess my point is, like, where do you experiment? Like, there, here's this thing that's totally solid and selling. Like, well, I, then again, Amazing Fantasy number 15.
They did it because it was well, it wasn't canceled. Selling. Yeah,
yeah. You know, it's like, let's just try this thing out.
Yep.
I do wish they kept the title as Amazing Adult Spider-Man. Could you imagine? That's Amazing Adult Fantasy.
Amazing Adult Spider-Man. He's a teenager.
Just totally confusing.
Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, talking of Amazing Spidey, let's take a break. And then when we come back, we will wrap up by talking about our last issue of the month, Amazing Spider-Man number 12.
Mm-hmm.
That's a transition. I'm going to leave that part in. Okay, we are back with one more issue to go. It's Amazing Spider-Man number 12, Unmasked by Dr. Octopus, which was written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko. And this one picks up right where we left off last issue. If you remember, Dr. Octopus had gotten out of prison. He had hooked up with some gangsters who had Betty Brant's brother in their clutches, and he was working as a mob lawyer for them. When Spider-Man tried to get in there and bust it up, Betty Brant's brother wound up getting shot and killed, which sort of ended the budding romance right there between Peter and Betty, because, you know, it's going to be hard to reveal that you're Spider-Man when you have just accidentally... almost killed her brother.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. You're an accessory.
I wonder what
it.
Spider-Man's death count is.
Oh, man.
It's high.
Through the roof.
It's like, at least a dozen.
Yeah.
And it's probably dozens.
Yeah. It's not Batman high, but it's high.
Right. Yeah. Just don't get tight with that guy.
I like how Batman is so adamant about I don't kill. And I was like, come on, bud.
Ancillary kills, though.
I don't kill. But if people happen to die around me, that's not really my fault.
Yeah. I'm just saying. Like, what?
So we picked up Doc Ock is still on the lam. Betty Brant has returned to New York and her job at the Daily Bugle. Doesn't seem too broken up about her murdered brother, but, you know, life is fast-paced in the big city.
Story must move on.
Exactly. Then we have the whole plot of this one, basically, is Doc Ock kidnaps Betty Brant because he wants to lure Spidey out of hiding. But Peter Parker has a bad cold, which seems like happens a lot to Peter Parker. He's either like injured or has a cold.
He does not have a spider's immune system.
No, he's just given a lot of blood to Aunt May. He can't fight.
Allergies, whatever. Yeah.
So they're in their first scrap, not only does Doc Ock just beat Spidey without even trying, he refuses to accept that Peter is Spider-Man after unmasking him.
Right. And then no one else accepts it.
Everyone's
like, this loser? Like, no, thanks.
It's pretty good.
Definitely not Spider-Man.
So. Yeah. But it makes Peter look very heroic because everyone's like, oh, he dressed up as Spider-Man to help rescue Betty. That is the greatest thing
that
we've
ever heard. That wimpy kid ran in.
And then, you know, he gets over his illness, he heads back out to fight Doc Ock and does a little bit better there. But
I feel like that one panel fever dream is a very Ditko moment.
Yeah, yes.
Spider-Man
where
yelling,
Spider-Man
at,
is
Peter
yelling
Parker.
At Peter Parker. Yeah. there's a lot of good Ditko moments in here, but one of the first things I wanted to talk about was just basically, so the cover shows Dr. Octopus removing Spider-Man's mask and exposing him to the world
in front of Jameson and cops.
And I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the unmasking tease, that trope in comics. Like, I feel like it's something we haven't really seen in Marvel comics yet, but this is a thing that I feel like every other issue of Superman at this point was like,
oh man,
Lois has revealed Superman's identity to the world, and then, you know, he finds a way to gaslight her into thinking that he's not Superman. And, mm-hmm. you know, and
trust me, for the millionth time, I'm not Clark Kent. That's always, I mean, I love Superman comics of that era, but I will say this is, I mean, they're always cop outs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is not, this tracks. This totally tracks. They're like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
That schlub.
Yeah. Like, that's what everyone would think.
And it works because, like, Dr. Octopus doesn't even believe it.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like when you've got, you know, the guy who.
And he also beat him so easily. So having that flu helped to sell this thing. But so it sells really well because he totally believes. He's just beat up a normal kid in a dumb costume.
And he's annoyed by it.
Yeah.
Because he's like, they're saying that a teenager fooled me. And it's like, which, you know, kind of gets at like Doc Ock's motivation, which is one of the reasons I really love the character. Like, he is not a stereotypical, like wants to, you know, amass a small fortune or take over the world or anything like that. He just wants to prove he's better than everyone else.
Right. Yeah.
which is great tracking all the way up to Superior Spider-Man.
Exactly. You know, it's like, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's just his obsession is being better than everyone else.
Yeah. He's a great character and just visually a great character too. Like the way that Ditko draws, you know, those arms and just the weight he gives to them.
And this does get to where we do talk occasionally with Ditko, especially when he gets to 9 panels, but we talk about it as storyboards. When there's an action scene of Ditko, they, like, there's this whole fight scene where Spider-Man climbs to the top of this smokestack and then jumps down and wraps, or like spins around it to strap Doc Ock onto this smokestack.
Yeah.
And all of it just reads so clearly. Like, there's no doubt you could take this and make the action happen.
That is fair.
Yeah.
It would not be as cool.
That's true.
Especially as, like, on a whole. I just feel the Ditko's use of time and, not time and space, like on page 17, where it has this panel of the Spider-Man's flipping into this hole. And he's falling down the hole, and like you change your perspective, and it makes you feel like you're in there.
Yeah,
you know, it's so wild.
Yeah, we've had all these condensed panels with action where they're going back and forth, you know, around the smokestack and, you know, down into the vent, and Spidey launches himself out of it, and then like in the middle of page 18, he just comes exploding, and it's like a full width panel, and you just like get the sense of like, here's the payoff. It's boom.
Haymaker.
Yeah.
Whap.
Well, I mean, you'll eventually get to it, but like those mastermind issues of Spider-Man.
Oh yeah.
Or the master plan or whatever it was called, you know, and that whole, someone pointed out that the paneling in that issue, it actually does the height of the panels increase the more that Spider-Man's actually pushing up.
Oh mm-hmm. yeah.
And so it's just a cool, such a cool, I feel Ditko at this point is outpacing everybody in terms of like, what can we do with this?
Yeah.
You know,
and there is,
and it's thinking of comics as a unit, which I feel like a lot of people, most people creating comics from inception till late 70s, early 80s are like, we just got to get this thing out.
Right.
Yeah.
And
I feel like Ditko was one of the guys who was from the beginning, just like, all right, I am creating this to be this, and that is it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, which arguably everyone was, is my point. But he's looking at it from an artistic standpoint.
Yes.
Where I feel everyone else is looking at it from a business standpoint.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is sort of the Alan Moore argument, too. Which is this is made for this medium.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, I'm wholly subscribe to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These Ditko Spider, actually, I forget if Marvel, and Leah does the guided storytelling or whatever you call it.
Yeah, yeah.
The Ditko stuff works so well for it.
It is perfect for it. Yeah.
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 No. Anyway.
Yeah.
Agreed.
This is totally changing the subject. One of my favorite little bits, Ditko was such a detailed artist, and, you know.
Is it the sign?
It's the sign, yeah. On page 14, the giant sign for a company called Lee Dit. Which is like, Lee Ditko, it's great. There's a million little details to pick out of this thing. When we do our panels of the month, like mine is almost, it's very frequently something that Ditko has drawn.
Well, I just love these panels in the museum where they all the statues fall on. And part of me, and this actually doesn't really feel like something Ditko would do,
mm-hmm.
but part of me is like, I just want to draw some cool stuff. He's going to fight in a museum now. So I'm going to draw this cool head because I went to the museum and I was sketching stuff out, and I'm going to draw this cool god-looking guy because whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, everything's on fire. As much as a, I mean, Sorry, Frank Miller, but Holy Terror was not very good. but the part where there's just a bunch of cool statues in the background,
yep.
I'm like, that's my favorite part.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, like I think he, especially with that comic, was like, I'm just going to draw monsters now.
Yep.
So there you go.
The part where he's not actively being hateful is the I am a huge Frank Miller fan.
I love his stuff.
I grew up one town over from Frank Miller.
Oh, wow.
And he was older than me and my friends, but a bunch of my friends got to go to the high school that he graduated from. And at the time, still like in one of the hallways, there was still like a Frank Miller mural that he had painted when he was a high school kid.
Oh, wow.
And it was just like, oh, man.
For my drawing style, when I mean, I was a graphic designer too, so yeah. But that, like Mignola and Frank Miller, that very, very huge contrast chiaroscuro thing, that's all I ever wanted to do. And
yeah.
And Ditko also, we've talked about this too, there are scenes, there's a lot of scenes where it doesn't happen, but there are scenes where he uses, it's just basically black and white, and he's some color later, but like Spider-Man's in the shadows and half, like one arm's coming out.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Just perfectly done that way.
It's real good. Should we it seems like we might be having a natural transition to talking about some of our favorite panels this month. So you want to talk some panel of the month?
Yeah, I'll give you my panel of the month since I wasn't here for it last month.
Oh, you got one from last month?
No, I don't have last month. I'm not gonna go. But I do. This month is from Spider-Man,
of course,
number 12 on page 12.
Mm-hmm.
This one, and usually my panels are the things that just strike my fancy and stick in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing I did not expect to see was, it's panel 5, Spider-Man swinging in to land on the back of a leaping lion.
Yes.
To redirect its leap. And so just Spider-Man riding a lion was not a thing I thought I was going to see today.
Yep.
Or yesterday when I read it. But it was a... I just giggled out loud, scared a cat, and which seemed appropriate.
Yep.
And just was like, all right, I'm putting that in there, and I hope Brian didn't pick it, because
I very nearly did.
Yeah.
We
often pick the same. We'll read 9 comics and pick the same panel. Yeah,
that's fine.
We also have the same birthday, which is a weird
whoa.
Thing.
So,
not the same year.
Not the same year. Yeah,
I'm 3 years older than this guy.
Oh, you're like the McElroy brothers.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly.
Justin Travis. Same day. Different year.
Yes. but yeah, no, it's
bodes well for the podcast.
I mm-hmm. think so. Yeah, mm-hmm. We have a future in this thing. Well, my panel is also from Amazing Spidey. It's on page 8, and it's the middle panel, third panel on the page. And so this is where Dr. Octopus has just beaten up the extremely ill Peter Parker, or extremely ill Spider-Man, and he's holding him in his arms and in his metal arms. And he's got one of the arms right on the top of the mask, and he's about to pull it off. And I just love the tension here. Like, Doc Ock's body language, he's, like, leaning a little bit back, so there's a weight to the arms that are supporting Spider-Man. Like, it's holding a lot of tension in there. And, like, I can imagine reading this as a kid for the first time. It's like the two panels above it, like, Doc Ock is just knocking Spidey around. Then he's got him. He's about to pull the mask off. He's like, oh, no, oh, no. And then at the bottom of the page, you see the mask coming off. And, right in front of Jameson and Betty Brant. And that's where the page ends, too. So now you have to flip the page to figure out, like, how is he going to get out of this? But I just love, like, right there, just how, you know, you're right at this peak of tension. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got, Joe?
I went for FF26.
Nice.
Because there was a panel that I felt was a great foretold Marvel to come, in a way.
Mm.
The page 14, panel 1. The panel is such a great layout. It looks pretty crude in the final execution, but it's there's 4 characters in it. It's not a huge panel, but it's totally clean, and I totally get what everyone's deal is. I get where the Hulk is going. The other thing, too, from a non-visual standpoint, is actually the second balloon where he talks about, there's Thor, the one thing I fear, that unbeatable hammer of his, I've got to move now. I think it's such a cool, it's like the term they use in pro wrestling, like putting somebody over.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like that's such a great, like, the heels putting over
yes.
the baby face moment. Yeah. Of in it, because I'm like, oh, I need to read Thor comics now.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, not because I'm sold this product, but because this guy is the only thing that scares Hulk. Yeah, I'm in.
There's
yeah.
a ton of this that this threads these threads yeah. throughout with references. I mean, everyone, Spider-Man referencing Human Torch and his power or his fame.
Yeah.
But when it's power, especially as if you put on your kid brain, like for me, it's always the like, but is the thing stronger?
Yeah,
I want
yeah.
to know. I'm waiting for these guys to tussle. Yeah.
But I just think it's such a great storytelling way of essentially selling something else.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it's not like shoehorned in. You know, I just, again, from like a craft perspective, I'm like, that's a great panel.
It's a real good panel.
From any every way about it. So that was my favorite.
Nice. One of the things I like about this issue as a whole is just how like everyone keeps their heat. You know, it's like everyone finishes this issue looking
that's
strong.
That's a great point.
Yeah. It's like the Avengers and the Fantastic Four are literally part ways saying it's like, well, we've had a chance to like get the measure of each other and we liked what we saw and we're looking forward to working with you again sometime. And you know, the Hulk only loses the fight because he's turned back into Banner. It's not his fault, you know. So so everyone comes, you know, everyone leaves looking strong and, you know, ready to go. So yeah, I love it.
Excellent.
Cool. This is one of the longer episodes we've ever done, but
sorry.
This is also... Oh,
I always warn people. I guess I didn't warn you guys. I just solely talk in tangents. So
I love tangents.
I don't think you heard either of us complaining about it. This is also right one on. Of the most fun episodes that we've done.
Right
and I
think it's a treat
that
it's longer.
Yeah, sweet. All right, cool.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for joining us, Joe.
Again, the invitation to talk about old Marvel comics is the easiest yes I've ever given.
All awesome. Right. Well, consider it an open invitation. We'd love to have you back.
You might want to rescind that. I would just come anytime. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So what have you got coming up that our listeners might be interested in? And where can they keep in the loop on what you've got going on?
The first question's really hard to answer because I'm in this strange spot where I've worked in games most of the year, and I'm actually working on another game next year. Because I did consciously kind of take a break from comics, kind of like, all right, well, this means too much to me just to like, I'll just admit it. Like, I felt a little burned out.
Sure.
So I was like, okay, well, what is this for me? What is this for me in 2019, 2020? And so everything I have right now is not announced. So it's this weird spot where it's like, well, this game thing is not going to come out for a year.
Right.
This comic thing's not going to come out. So I'm doing all this stuff. I will say I just had a story published in the Megadeth anthology Heavy Metal did. And I have a story with a graffiti artist, Nick Walker, which we totally riffed on Simic for lettering. It's super dope by Ferran Delgado. I pitched Heavy Metal and I was like, dude, we have to get Ferran Delgado to letter this because he's the only guy who can do a good Simic. and he did an amazing job. And so I forget the issue number, but it's, I think, the November or December issue of Heavy Metal. And then I have a, it's not an announcement, but who cares, because it's pretty laid back. I'm doing I wrote a story in Savage Dragon 250, but all my longer form comic stuff, I don't know when it's going to get announced. It's probably going to be a while.
All right.
Well, but I will say, I just read the first issue of Ringside, and it was awesome, and I would recommend it for anybody to pick up on whatever Comixology, you know,
or get the graphic novels. Brought the other ones here.
It was great. I was looking for something that just piqued my interest out of your catalog, and I was like, that. And nice. And it totally, I'm hooked, and I'm going to go read the rest. Awesome. So I would recommend that. Yeah. Right.
You've got a good website.
Enjoy
the website.
Thank you. JoeKeating.com. I think everything, I'm on Twitter, but I've kind of abandoned it, honestly.
We're barely on Twitter.
Yeah. But I do love Instagram. Yep. I'm on there, which I occasionally update with like, I love posting. If you like old books, movie theater marquees, my dog, it's kind of, but anyway, it's JoeKeatinge. And it's either .com or Twitter or Instagram or Tumblr, I guess.
Cool. Okay. Right on.
But yeah, go there. I'll have some stuff. I'm really hoping for something out soon because, it is weird to be like, you hate being the guy who's like, it's secret. You know, like, all right, jerk, whatever, man. Yeah.
Well, we'll make sure to
have you back on. It's not like I'm dealing with nuclear codes.
We'll keep having you on, so you'll be on when you can plug, plug and launch it.
Invitation accepted.
Awesome. Right on. We say this every week, but I'm just going to say it again. You can find us at marvelbythemonth.com. You can hit us up on Instagram at marvelbythemonth. Drop us an email, marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. I think that's it.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, in that case, my name is Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.